Steve, it's coming to an end. Our year-long trek around the globe with National Geographic, and we've been calling Climate Connections. In our last few stories, we're looking to the future, and today we go to India.
Which has a lot of new problems that come along with rapid development. India also has a lot of new problem solvers, though. Young Indians, born in America, Britain, and Australia, are traveling back to India. That's where they're going to work for startup companies or NGOs, non-governmental organizations. They're tackling pollution and carbon emissions and recycling and energy. NPR's Robert Krulwich meets some of India's climate change generation.
If you go to India to see water pollution projects, air pollution projects, green architecture projects, global warming initiatives, what you find naturally are lots of young Indians working away, but surprisingly often, right there with them on the front lines are kids who look Indian until they open their mouths. For example, Preet Gowder.
I'm a venture capitalist.
Is a young guy who lends money to the poor.
Are you an Indian?
I'm an Indian.
You're an Indian.
Yeah, yeah. I consider India home. As soon as I come
you
into the city.
You don't sound Indian, though.
I don't. I was born in Alabama.
As so many Indians are.
Right.
And you?
My name is Ranu Sinha, and I'm a consultant.
My name is Dave Madden, or Dave Madan in Indian context. My mom and dad are both from India.
At a restaurant in a Delhi neighborhood, I ran into a bunch of these folks and their friends who are part of a growing wave of British, Australian, and American-born Indians who've decided to move to India.
I'm not just someone walking around with an American accent talking about social development just to be cool, that I'm actually going to do something about it.
Their friends in India, local Indians, have a nickname for these Americans. They call them ABCDs, American-born confused Desis. Desis is an Indian slang word. It describes a new arrival searching for his inner Indianness, says Indian Gaurav Shori.
So what ends up is an American-born confused Desi.
And you know a lot of these guys and women?
Thank God I don't know.
Why? What's wrong with them? This is a long story, but because of their American diplomas, very much honored here, these returnees get terrific jobs in India, better jobs than the local young Indians get.
The ABCDs, by virtue of their accent and style and having lived in the West, are given a lot more importance by the social, upper social strata in India as well. So they kind of get their due importance and they get their, I'm sure they get a lot more women than we do.
They get their women.
As well. So... Which is the case, because where I read about this, it was really crazy. Maxim India ran this amazing article about how the ABCDU comes by virtue of having eaten beef most of his life. He's bigger than the normal Indian guy, and he has this deeper voice, and he dresses well, and he's got an accent, so the chicks fall for him.
The chicks fall for him.
I love that. It was brilliant. It was really awesome.
But his less jealous moments, Gaurav says, well, the truth is, India needs these young Americans and these Western kids because they know stuff that the young Indians don't know.
They come with amazing perspectives, amazing insights that Western countries have experienced over their development cycle, which India is going through now and making a lot of the mistakes that the West made, say, perhaps 20, 30 years back. So the insights that we get from these people are extremely beneficial to us.
So take this situation. Any day on the streets of Delhi, you can see a crush of new cars, new stores, bigger and bigger malls. All signs that the economy here is growing very fast. And most young Indians, says Ranu, they like it that way.
We're growing and we like this growth and it's exciting. And no, we don't want to hear doomsday stories about some glacier melting in the future and coasts, sea levels rising 20, 30 years from now. We don't want anything that will stop this growth.
If you drive to the south end of Delhi, a neighborhood that 9 years ago, by the way, was empty.
Literally just desert and sand and there were no buildings.
Now it is a strip of 10, maybe 15 shopping malls that are titanic in size. I went there with a young Indian, Leon Marinas.
I mean, look at the vastness of it is really echoing, right?
And do your friends like it in a place like this? I mean, would they?
Yeah, because this is exactly what they aspire for. I mean, Domino's is here, Pizza Hut is there.
And so is the plastic, and so are the cups and the bottles and the wrapping paper.
Plastic bags, trash in terms of non-biodegradables. That's new, and people don't really understand what to do with that.
Typically, trash was picked up by a special group called rag pickers, but there's now so much trash they can't collect it all.
I had no idea how waste worked in Delhi.
So Carolyn Howe asked her landlord,
you know, what do we do with our waste? Like, do you have a setup with the rag pickers in the neighborhood? Where do you leave the waste? He said, oh, just throw it off the roof. That was the moment I decided I was going to move out. But it was also, I mean, and he did. He just threw, instead of paying 30 rupees, 75 cents a month to have someone pick up our trash, he threw it off the balcony onto these train tracks.
This happens all the time, says Indian Neeraj Doshi. People will keep a clean house.
But the problem is that responsibility lies only until my boundary. Beyond that, that's not my area. So
if it leaves my house, it's not my problem.
Exactly.
So there's a lack of we-ness of community that the Western kids particularly seem to notice and they think needs to be addressed.
And it's as simple as that. It's a conversation that needs to happen between people.
And to start that conversation, for example, Neeraj, working with a young Westerner, hopes to finance a new garbage collection company. And meanwhile, his friends, they talk about using movies to raise consciousness.
A good Bollywood movie on climate change here would really kind of increase awareness, in my own perspective.
Maybe Alexis Ringwald is right, but her friend Preet thinks she's wrong. Actors don't create lasting change.
What they want from movie stars is kind of their glamour for the 10 minutes.
But these conversations between young Americans and British and Indians, they can change minds. Young people talking together are critical for new ideas in India, he thinks.
I hear these conversations happening here. I don't hear them anywhere else.
But because they are so constant and so intense, these young friendships may create a new kind of we, a pan-Indian we-ness, says Neeraj.
Yeah, the we is all of us. All of us is we, and that's what my thing is. We are all of us are we.
And who knows, this conversation could go on for a while.
And it's why I'm here now. It's why I'm probably going to spend the majority of the rest of my life here.
I would be one of the same. This is going to be part of my life for the rest of my life.
Well, we'll see about that, because, you know, it's very trashy here and cranky and difficult.
It's not. It's far more beautiful, stunning, it's amazing, it's frustrating. It's diverse, it's complicated, and it's mine.
Robert Krulwich, NPR News.
Much more Climate Connections is at npr.org/climate.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. A county in southwest Florida achieved a distinction earlier this year. In February, Florida's Lee County had more foreclosures than any other place in America. It's the same pattern we've seen elsewhere. Prices rose rapidly just a few years ago, and now many people owe more than their homes are worth. But in Lee County, the decline is so extreme that some people are walking away from their properties. NPR's Jim Zaroli has more.
If you want to understand what's happened to Florida real estate, you can start by visiting Cape Harbor. It's one of numerous gleaming new developments that have popped up in recent years. There's a pair of condo towers overlooking the Gulf of Mexico, a shopping area modeled on a Mediterranean village, and a sun-drenched marina packed with boats bobbing gently in the water. Real estate agent Robin Speronis says 3 years ago, people lined up to buy property here.
It was very exciting. In this second high-rise that went up, all the units were sold within hours. It was a lottery. They were almost lined up overnight to get their lottery tickets in order to the opportunity to purchase a condo.
If you were lucky enough to own a home in Cape Harbor, like Speronis and her husband, people were offering two or three times what you paid for it.
In 2005, we saw what was going on. We sold it. We made over $300,000.
How could you know what was going on in 2005?
Because we went through it in Massachusetts in the late 80s, early 90s. So when they offered about $600,000 for my property that I paid $260,000 for in 2000, I'm like, sure, you can have it.
The couple traveled for a few years. Then they returned to Cape Harbor and bought another place. Only by then, the boom was over.
You've got your laundry room over here, dining room, living room.
Today, Speronis takes me through an empty condo next door to her own. The owner couldn't sell it, and now the bank is seizing it. Of the 24 units in this area, Speronis counts at least four that are in foreclosure or heading there. Another has a lien for non-payment of condo fees, and the owners of yet another are in bankruptcy. What's happened here has happened all over Lee County. In 2005, almost 30,000 new homes were built here, twice as many as the population growth warranted. Today, there are 19,000 unsold homes, six times as many as 2 years ago.
So it's a classic case of a real estate bubble where the market builds and builds and builds until the point that it's overbuilt and then it collapses.
Shelton Weeks, professor of real estate at Florida Gulf Coast University, says much of the real estate fervor in Lee County was driven by speculators. He says in some condo towers, as many as three-quarters of the units were bought by investors. Weeks says he even had students who were buying and flipping houses. When the boom ended, so did their real estate careers.
Unfortunately, most of those folks ran into some significant difficulty about 12 to 18 months after that peak.
There are people like 47-year-old Marcus Netto. Today he's driving me around Fort Myers to see the remnants of his real estate empire. 3 years ago, he moved here and bought a townhouse. He also bought a condo as an investment and a timeshare in Orlando. Then Netto's wife left him and his mortgage rate readjusted upward. He now has to work two jobs to pay all the mortgages and taxes he owes.
I got almost $4,000 every month. It's a lot of money for me. I don't make that.
But he also can't sell any of his properties. They're not worth what he owes. So Netto is trying to arrange short sales, basically a way of getting the bank to absorb the losses on his properties. Real estate agent Robin Speronis says a lot of people in Lee County are looking for ways to bail out of their mortgages. Speronis says prices have come down so much that some people are even choosing to abandon their properties because they can get a better deal somewhere else in the area.
I talk to buyers every day that are paying their mortgage, that can afford their mortgage, but are not going to pay it anymore. They're going to buy a house, either a foreclosure or something that's really low in price, and once they get the loan for that, they're going to stop paying on the other property.
The result, she believes, is going to be more and more foreclosures coming on the market. The glut of bank-owned properties is beginning to draw bargain hunters. That, combined with the fact that few new homes are being built, means the huge inventory of unsold homes in Lee County may be starting to shrink. But Fishkind & Associates, a consulting firm, says prices probably haven't hit bottom yet. Shelton Weeks says the backlog of unsold homes is affecting market psychology.
We have a lot of folks who are, I think, are here and interested in buying that would take some of this inventory off the market, but nobody wants to be that first mover. They would all like to wait until they're sure we're at the bottom.
And the problem's being aggravated by the economic downturn. Real estate is a major industry in Lee County, and with construction at a halt, unemployment is 6.5%, well above the Florida average. So many construction workers are leaving, which means fewer buyers and more abandoned homes. With the flood of baby boomers heading toward retirement, Lee County will inevitably recover from the real estate crash. But with so many homes on the market, that probably won't happen anytime soon. Jim Zaroli, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. We're going to hear next from one of the most frequently quoted people you rarely hear. Antonin Scalia is among the most outspoken members of the Supreme Court. Because he's a judge, he rarely takes questions on the record from reporters, but he did speak with us. Here's NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg.
Antonin Scalia is a man of many contradictions. An only child, he's the father of nine children. Tough-minded and thick-skinned in public, in private, he suffers when attacked. Often confrontational on the bench and sarcastic, even acidic in dissent, in private, he's charming and funny. Scalia has made his biggest mark so far in those biting dissents. His pen is an unsparing skewer. He's mocked Chief Justice John Roberts, a fellow conservative, accusing him of, quote, faux judicial restraint. He said Justice Sandra Day O'Connor's view on abortion, quote, cannot be taken seriously. And just this month, he derided Justice John Paul Stevens' views on the death penalty, calling them, quote, the purest form of rule by judicial fiat. even though Stevens agreed with Scalia on the end result. So I asked Justice Scalia if using that kind of language in written opinions is wise, whether in fact it might not alienate potential allies on the court.
When it is wrong, it should be destroyed.
Destroyed?
I think all of the reasons it is wrong should be pointed out, and pointed out forcefully. And I don't mind people doing that to my opinions. A good, hard-hitting dissent keeps you honest.
Scalia is famous as a so-called originalist and textualist, or as he puts it, my Constitution is not living, it is dead. It means what the framers intended back at the founding of the Republic. So if capital punishment was constitutional in 1791, it still is today.
Whatever they understood then is, in my view, the meaning. And it's not up to me to say, well, it really shouldn't mean that anymore. It should mean something different. Once you get into that boat, you have no criterion. It's up to the individual preferences of nine justices. And that's just not the way it ought to work.
So if you put people in stocks in the public square, which was a common practice then?
I would say that may be very stupid. But it's not unconstitutional if indeed it was a punishment that was at that time accepted. Now, you know, the more ridiculous you make the example, the less likely it is to occur. They used to notch ears, too.
Contrary to public perceptions, Scalia and fellow conservative Clarence Thomas do not march in lockstep. Thomas is far less willing to abide by the court's past decisions, while Scalia says he does not believe in undoing most of what's become law until now.
I am a textualist, I am an originalist, I am not a nut.
His mantra is that states are free to do what they want about most of the controversial questions of the day. They can legalize abortion or not, legalize homosexual conduct or not, legalize assisted suicide or not. But when Oregon did, in fact, legalize assisted suicide, Scalia dissented on other grounds. He's accused his fellow justices of taking sides in the culture wars. His critics say that it is he who's taken sides by the tone of his dissents. For example, in the case where the court struck down a state law that made private homosexual conduct a crime.
I don't know why that's taking sides. The next step is for the court to say that same-sex marriage must be permitted. It's hard to distinguish the one from the other.
Hasn't happened in this court, though, has it?
Well, it happened in Canada, didn't it? It is a living constitutional principle, and Canada's a living constitution court.
Scalia is no stranger to criticism from all quarters. When he provided the fifth vote striking down a law making it a crime to burn the American flag, his own wife, Maureen, greeted him in the morning singing, "It's a grand old flag."
I got a lot of heat from that opinion, really. Serious, biting criticism from the quarter that I usually don't get criticism from. That is to say, from the right rather than the left. And I just want to give credit to a wonderful gentleman who was President Bush I. He wrote a handwritten note, not to me. I think he would have thought that was improper. But he wrote it to Maureen, saying, and I see your husband's been getting a lot of criticism for his flag-burning decision. You tell him not to worry about it. He did the right thing. Isn't that a nice thing for the president to do? I mean, gee, he had a lot of other things to worry about. I'm eternally grateful for that. It was such a nice gesture.
With the addition of two new Bush appointees on the Supreme Court, Scalia's views are now on the verge of prevailing in most cases for the first time in his tenure.
In the big cases, I'm maybe not as much of a big loser as I used to be, if you want to keep score. But, you know, winning, losing, isn't it? That's never been my objective. And it's my hope that in the fullness of time, the majority of the court will come to see things, at least for the future.
He is so beloved by the political right that some conservatives dream of him as a vice presidential candidate with John McCain. Scalia reacts with a huge guffaw.
For one thing, Senator McCain's one of the accomplishments he was proudest of was McCain-Feingold campaign financing reform, and I thought the whole thing was unconstitutional. the court approved it, but not with my blessing. So, you know, when someone, what should I say, disparages what you think is your life's principal achievement, you're not likely to want him to be on your presidential ticket. Besides which, ask my wife. I'd be a lousy politician. I'd say what I thought.
And
that's not what politicians should do.
In recent years, Scalia has abandoned his one-time reticence about talking in public. He, like other justices before him, is giving a few select interviews to promote his book. And yet he and other justices forbid cameras in the Supreme Court. Some question why the justices should be able to turn the spigot on and off at will.
You're darn right we can.
Why?
Why? It's my voice, it's my face. I don't have to show it, except where I want to. Why is that so extraordinary?
Unlike some, Scalia does not speak only to friendly audiences. He's appeared in debates with fellow justices and with the head of the ACLU at an ACLU national meeting. He concedes that's a big change from the days when he followed the maxim that judges should not be seen or heard.
But the reality is that in modern times, in what my father used to call the space age, where there's all this dead space to be filled on radio and television and in the press, I'm going to be a public spectacle whether I like it or not. It's mostly whether the public is going to get a picture of me that's secondhand or rather at least have some opportunities to hear firsthand what I have to say and assess firsthand what I'm like.
Justice Antonin Scalia, his new book, written with lexicologist Brian Garner, is Making Your Case, The Art of Persuading Judges. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
And you can hear more from Justice Scalia's interview later today on All Things Considered. One more note on the Supreme Court. Today, the High Court upheld a state law that requires photo identification at the polls. In a 6-3 ruling, the court backed an Indiana law that its supporters said was aimed at deterring voter fraud. Opponents of the law said it was meant to discourage poor, elderly, and minority voters. As the economy slows down, we owe it to ourselves to consider all the debt we've piled on ourselves. For many Americans, an inflated mortgage is just the start. There's also the car loan, plenty of credit cards.
And much more. We're going to talk about debt all week because that pattern is a change from what many of our parents did. Consider this number. Back in the early 1980s, Americans saved more than 11% of their income. Last year, on average, Americans saved 0.5%.
Steve, that's no savings.
Well, basically, although perhaps some people are wondering how they managed to save that 0.5%. Anyway, we're going to begin this series with an economist, Financial Times columnist Tim Harford, who's been studying that debt. Why has there been such a big change in the personal savings rate in the last few decades?
I think the biggest thing is that lenders have been willing to lend. If you go back 20, 30, 40 years, a lot of people were denied credit. They were denied credit because of their income. They were denied credit because of their gender, because of their race. So people have suddenly been given the ability to borrow more, credit cards, mortgages, unsecured loans, and they've taken advantage of that.
Wait a minute. You've already contradicted, I think, some of the conventional wisdom on this because I think it's assumed that people were in the past more virtuous or more focused on savings. You're saying it's not about the borrowers, it's about the lenders.
Well, that seems to be what's happened. If you look at the increased financial sophistication of any developed country, the more sophisticated the financial system, the better it has been at producing loans and packaging them and selling them to people. And it seems to me that we've always been willing to borrow. We've always been keen to borrow if the lenders have been willing to lend to us.
So basically what's happened is you've got a lending industry that's got a product, loans, that it is figuring out more and more creative ways to sell to us. In your view, that's what's happening here.
Yeah, I think so, yes.
Is it a bad thing?
It's been a good thing until recently. The availability of credit to people to buy their own homes, the availability of credit to people to smooth consumption, you know, broadly, that's a good thing. But clearly, the last couple of years, it's just gone crazy, and loans have been made that people couldn't possibly repay.
Well, now, let me figure this out. You're saying that it has been, at least until recently, a very good thing that people had so many more options, that they could smooth out their incomes. They have all kinds of opportunities because credit is available. That should be a good thing. But is there something about the availability of credit itself that causes people to go off the rails and make bad decisions?
Well, one of the things that worries me is evidence from what you might call behavioral economics or what you might call economic psychology about the way we sometimes make short-term decisions. And we seem to be hardwired sometimes to just make rash decisions in the short term. For example, economists offer their experimental subjects a choice of a snack. Do you want fruit or do you want chocolate? And depending on when they were offered the snack, do you want to eat it now or do you want to eat it in a week's time? People would make different decisions. They would choose chocolate now, but if you said, well, what do you want to eat in a week's time? People would think forward. They'd think, well, fruit is healthier. I'll pick fruit.
Oh, there's, no way. As long as they don't have to eat it now.
As long as you don't have to eat it now. And of course, what would happen is a week down the track, the economist who did the experiment would show up with the fruit and, you know, here's the fruit you asked for. By the way, would you like to swap for a Hershey bar? And then suddenly people would go, yeah, I must have been crazy a week ago when I thought I'd want fruit. Give me the chocolate now.
So is the analogy there that if you have to save and wait several years before you can buy a house, you might buy a house you can afford, but if you can buy any kind of house today, you might buy something that's completely irresponsible and beyond your means, or just risky. You don't know if you're going to be able to pay it off.
Or you might decide to buy some clothes, a car, a hi-fi now, because right now that seems like, you know, the thing you really want to do. But if you were to be asked in a week's time, if you were to see that designer handbag, if you saw the perfect pair of shoes, would you buy it? You'd go, no, I can't afford to spend money like that on shoes. But then when you actually get down the track and you're right there, you have the credit card, so you can buy it, you know, instantly with no consequences. The consequences come further down the track. So one of the things that economists are trying to think about now is, how do we help people to reflect that longer-term perspective in the decisions they make today? One thing that they're doing, for example, economists have designed a pension saving system called Save More Tomorrow. What they do is they teamed up with companies, and the companies offer their employees the usual choice, you know, would you like to contribute some of your salary to your pension plan? But it's not phrased in the usual way. Rather than saying, do you want to do that now? They say, you know, 9 months down the track, a year down the track, you're going to get a pay rise. At that point, do you want us to send your pay rise direct into your pension account? When people are given that choice, that's suddenly a lot more attractive. People are very keen.
So everybody who's always meaning to save next year is given the opportunity to actually commit to save next year.
Absolutely. It's almost like saying to yourself, you know, I'll quit smoking next year. Only in this particular case, the company is actually able to enforce that decision. And it's been shown to be very, very effective in increasing savings rates.
We're talking with Financial Times columnist Tim Harford about debt, maybe yours, maybe mine. And I'd like to know, Mr. Harford, if the national savings rate went back up again from 0.4% up to 10, 11, 12%, would we be better off?
I think it depends how high it goes. The basic trade-off is this. If you want to be richer in the future, the obvious way to do that is to save rather than spend now. But generally, we get richer in the future because we get smarter, because technology improves and so on. So how much do you want to sacrifice your income now for income later when you're, you know, when you're richer? I think about my own experience. 15 years ago, I was a student. And I was one of those rare students. I was studying economics, right? So, you know, we're all kind of perverse and a bit different, who actually saved money. You know, I got myself a job. I was really careful about the money I spent. Mm-hmm. Now, did I make the right decision? I made completely the wrong decision. That was crazy. I was saving just a few hundred dollars. As a student, there were so many things that for just $10 or for $20, you'd have such a wonderful evening. And yet you're scrimping and saving and you're working and working and working to try and earn this money. And, you know, now I wouldn't even notice. The idea that the former me sent a few hundred dollars forward in time to me now, you know, if only I could send it back, I would. If only I could send it back, I would. And actually, that's what debt is. Debt is your future self sending you money back in time. So the question is, are you and your future self both happy with the deal? And clearly you can borrow too much, but you can also save too much. We've just got to get the balance right, and that's not easy because the future is uncertain.
Tim Harford of the Financial Times. Got 20 bucks?
Oh, sure. For a moderate rate of interest, happily lend it to you.
Great, thanks. We'll work out the terms off the air. Good talking with you.
Thanks, Steve.
Mr. Harford is a Financial Times columnist and author of The Logic of Life. These conversations continue tomorrow when we're going to meet a consumer who is trying to dig herself out of credit card debt. And you can track America's savings rate and borrowing binge at npr.org. The musician Justin Townes Earl was addicted to drugs until the day a friend dragged him to the hospital.
I suffered respiratory failure after being awake for 14 days. I've always known that, like, if you walk into the emergency room, and first off, they don't make you wait. Like, they go, oh, God, you come here, and they grab you. You know you're in trouble, and then you know you're in double trouble when the scissors come out and they start cutting your clothes off.
Earl says he's been clean 4 years now. And when he brought his guitar by our studios, the young musician wore a denim work shirt and signs of an eventful life. Is the tattoo on your arm from before or after this experience that got you clean?
Which one?
It was early in the morning, early for a musician anyway, just hours before he'd been performing the song that he prepared to play for us.
I was thinking about taking all my songs down a half a step this morning, so see if I can atone for my deeper baritone this morning.
And he started a tune that helps you get deeper into Earl's story. He plays guitar without a pick, flicking his fingers across the strings like a man shaking water off his hand. Justin Townes Earl carries the names of two acclaimed songwriters, Townes Van Zandt and Earl's own father, Steve. This song describes a man with a chaotic life. It took Earl years to get it recorded because he had a chaotic life.
Well, I take my time in coming, take my time in leaving. If you ask me where I'm going, tell you when it's needed. Oh, you know why, you'll never be what you ain't glad I'm leaving, girl, you know you ought to be, baby. Yeah, cause I lie, cheat, a gamble, and I steal from any man. Well, from Georgia to Los Angeles, Texas up to Maine, I'm a wanted man. Is that the kind of life you want to lead? You ain't glad I'm leaving, girl, you know you ought to be.
Justin Townes Earl. I don't want to assume that when you sing in the first person, you're singing about yourself, but are you trying to tell us something about yourself with that song?
At the time that I wrote it, I was trying to tell everybody something about myself. I do advertise it at shows as a warning, but then again, it is a performance and a show.
What time did you write it?
I was 15 or 16 years old when I wrote that song.
Well, yeah. Let's mention what was happening with your father. It's been very public. He had drug abuse problems. He was arrested for drug-related crimes. He spent some time in prison. Were you, in a sense, acting out then if you were a problem kid?
I don't know if in my family you could call it acting out. I think it was kind of playing along with the game. I mean, I didn't do anything differently than what my father was doing. I mean, it's a really hard family to rebel in. I could have become an accountant, or I could have become a Republican. That would have really pissed him off.
He's politically active and much more on the leftward side of things.
Yes, he is.
Would this be a period when you were also getting involved with drugs?
Yeah, I'd already been involved in them.
Was there a period where your father was trying to wag his finger at you and say, you shouldn't do that, I don't want you to get involved in these things?
My dad's a big finger wagger. He's full of advice. But back then, you know, it's just like any teenager. There's no such thing as a teenager that listens to a single word their father says.
Because we are talking here about people giving advice, I wonder if you could play a song of yours in which I think the narrator is trying to give advice, but trying to say he's not giving any advice. Who am I to say?
Yeah, I can do that.
Well, now who am I to say? If all I know is what I heard, with the things some people say, you can never be too sure. So you take your pills and poison, drink yourself to death, give yourself away until you ain't got nothing left. 'Cause who am I to say that there's anything wrong with that? Oh, but why do you call? It's such hours every time, saying I don't need no money, I just been thinking of you tonight. Oh, but who am I to say that it wasn't for the better, girl? Who am I to say now?
Justin Townes Earl. You must have realized as a very young man, hey, I've got some talent here. And like it or not, I've got some connections. I could really make something of myself, or I could waste my life.
It was a friend of mine actually named Scotty Melton who I met at a party at this house that I'd been living at for a while with a bunch of guys. And Scotty was nowhere near as like father. Like, he never tried to stop me from doing anything. But as far as songwriting goes and direction with my work, he was giving me all the same advice that my father gave me. The only difference is I listened to Scotty.
Oh, because it's so easy to ignore the advice of your loved ones, even if it's good advice.
Well, exactly. And it's a lot easier for anybody to listen to somebody who you can get high with, or I could have a drink with, you know, and that wasn't going to happen with my father.
What then finally forced the decision?
Well, it was my body finally forced me to make a change. I mean, I'd pretty much crippled my insides. I mean, I had the liver of a, you know, still do have the liver of a 60-year-old alcoholic, you know, and it's, I wouldn't say that I'm stable, but I know that I'm very happy and comfortable living without the use of drugs now, you know, and I've been lucky that I haven't had an urge to get high or drink, and I'm just hoping that that stays away.
That's Justin Townes Earl. His new album is The Good Life. You can hear how he was inspired by his grandfather and the Civil War at NPR.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inske.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. On Mondays, we focus on technology. Today, we look at websites that bring hungry web surfers together with their favorite foods. Plenty of sites on the internet allow ordinary people to review restaurants, and good reviews on sites like Chowhound and Yelp can help a restaurant. Now, tech-savvy food lovers are creating a new kind of culinary website that steers people towards smaller, harder-to-find eateries. Cyrus Farivar reports.
It's a Friday evening in Sacramento, California, and Joshua Lurie Terrell is setting out for an early dinner at one of his favorite taco trucks in the northern part of town.
Dos lengua. I have a bottle of water, too. What do you want?
He's the creator of YumTacos.com, an online map of taco trucks in the United States. It's a great example of a new category of websites that alerts people to small restaurants that probably would never make it into a fancy food guide. It focuses primarily on California. Lurie Terrell lives here in Sacramento.
You know, I was keeping a list. I carry a little notebook usually around with me. I don't have it right now. And I was keeping a list, and as soon as a couple of friends of mine knew I had this list, people were calling me all the time saying, you know, I'm in the South area. I'm really hungry. It's like 10 o'clock. I had pho already this week. I need something different. I'd say, oh, taco truck at, you know, the corner of 65th and Stockton, and there they were.
From there, it was a short leap to compiling this information on an online map. He's a graphic designer by trade and loves maps. Plus, his wife is a cartographer. Once he had the map, people from around the country started writing in.
There's several in Baltimore, Maryland, which was kind of surprising to me. I've been to Baltimore many times, and it did not seem like the kind of place where you had any hope of finding authentic Mexican food.
Lurie Terrell is turning people onto small businesses that they might not otherwise find. One of the earliest food maps was made by Adam Kubin, the founder of SliceNY.com, a blog devoted to pizza, and specifically New York pizza.
I could just as easily put the pizzerias in a list, say, in the sidebar or some such. But the advantage of having it on a map is that it's visual and people can click on it. They can zoom in to their neighborhood and see, like, hey, there's five pizza slices here, which is what I use on the map, pizza slices, for my pinpoints. That means there's good stuff around me. And then they can go and look and see where it is.
But what if your neighborhood is the entire country? That was the problem for Brian Huey, a graduate student at the University of Southern California who splits his time between Los Angeles and the Bay Area. Huey is like a lot of Chinese immigrants who don't cook. They comprise a large market of people nationwide who want a little taste of home. That's how ChineseFoodMap.com was born, an entirely Chinese language site with reviews plotted in major metro areas around the country, including Houston, Seattle, and Atlanta. But chances are, your favorite local Chinese restaurant isn't on the list.
The Chinese restaurant for Chinese here and the Chinese restaurant for non-Chinese is kind of totally different. That's why Chinese people need a website for themselves.
If you can't read Chinese and feel like you're missing out on the good stuff, fear not. Huey wants to help his favorite Chinese restaurants get new, non-Chinese customers. He plans on completing an English version of the site by the end of the summer. For NPR News, I'm Sarus Farivar.